Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
I want to welcome Elaine Kmark to the enemies list today. Elaine is one of these really smart people about how things work and how they don't in American politics. She served in the Clinton White House, particularly on something that I thought at the time was kind of important. And I think it did some good work. And we sort of, as a country, whether it was anybody else, Bush or Obama or Trump after that, kind of let it drop, which was the reinventing government to like look at how things work and don't work in government. But Elaine's also very smart about how American primary politics work. And you know, I think you were getting a lot of folks who were asking you questions earlier in the year about like, what happens if Joe Biden steps down? What happens if there's a Democratic primary, which I was always very short on those things. But, you know, it's interesting that the Republican primary is technically over, but it doesn't actually seem to be over quite yet, does it? I mean, we still seem to have a bubbling of Nikki Haley voters out there. So, like I said, welcome to the show. I want to just talk to you about a couple things. Like, where do you see the state of the race in American politics right now?
I think it's very unclear, okay? On the one hand, you have all these polls showing Donald Trump very close. And in some states, some swing states even leading. Although since the State of the Union, those polls have closed and now it looks like a neck and neck. Some of these polls are faulty. Some of them have very small sample sizes. Some of them people think are over sampling Trump voters in order to not make the same kinds of mistakes they made in 2016 when they undersampled Trump voters. I mean, you know, so you've got the polling world over here. Let's put it over in one basket. Then you've got another basket, which is what I call the more of the plate tectonics of politics basket. Okay, the what are the fundamentals, right? And the fundamentals on the pro-Trump side are the persistent overhang of inflation. And the fact that inflation is a different kind of economic problem because everybody feels it every day. They feel it in groceries. They feel it in gas. And so even though all the other economic indicators are terrific, okay, and people have jobs, we are at full employment. It's amazing the job growth. Wages have actually gone up. But the wages haven't gone up in enough to offset the inflation, so people don't really appreciate it. So on the Trump side, I'd say we're looking at a lot of polls that look very good for him, and we're looking at inflation. After that, however, you got to look at the plate tectonics. And the plate tectonics say there were 7 million people, more people who voted for Biden than voted for Trump. 4 years ago. And it's hard to imagine what will move those people into the Trump column. They're mad. You know, they say, oh, Joe Biden's too old, this, that, and the other thing. Hard to imagine somebody who voted for Biden 4 years ago suddenly deciding they're going to vote for Trump, particularly with all of the problems that Trump has. And there you look at really one overarching issue. Trump has never tried, from the time he was in the White House through this campaign, he has never tried to expand his base. He only talks to his base. And the base loves the outrageous things he says. They like the fact that he's a tough guy, et cetera, et cetera. But most presidential candidates while they're president and when they're running again, try to expand their base. He has never tried to expand the base.
It's interesting that you say that, because both Bill Clinton and Karl Rove did a base plus for George W. Bush in the first election, did a base plus strategy. They knew they had to expand outside of the box. Both sides of the aisle knew they had to get outside of that box. And it is interesting. Jonathan Martin had an interesting piece this morning, like, why isn't Joe Biden reaching out to more Republicans, which I think is a legitimate question right now. He's sort of been trying to like pin down the base. And I get that. I understand that incentive inside an election. Yeah, I do think there's a bigger, look at the Lincoln Project. We do this because, you know, we believe this fundamentally. There's a bigger opportunity for Joe Biden to get Republican voters this time, I think, than there was in 2020. I think the pool has expanded, right?
Yeah. All you have to do is look at the last election night and look at Nikki Haley's withdrawal. Biden was out in a nanosecond saying she ran a good campaign. Welcome, right? Biden made an overt plea for her voters, which makes sense. And what did Trump do? Trump insulted her voters first by calling them a bunch of lefties.
You're not welcome here.
You're not welcome, right? And insulting her. Now, it couldn't be a more stark example of what's going to go on in this presidential election, right? Because a lot of people think that Trump, while his base is rock solid, and enthusiastic, that his base is somewhere between 45% and 47%. And where that 45% and 47% vote makes a big difference, right? What we saw with the Republican primaries is there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of Republican voters, and I'm averaging here, who will not vote for Donald Trump. And the question now is, are they going to stay home? They got to leave the top of the ticket blank, because you can do that. You can vote for the down ballot Republicans on the down ballot, not vote at the top. Or are some of them going to go for Biden? And given there are two states, Arizona and Georgia, where the Biden margin was very, very small. It was five digits. It was 10,000 and 11,000. In those two states, a couple of 20% of Haley voters voting for Biden, that could deliver the state.
She ranged from 14%, which was the Florida number, to 50% in Vermont. If you end up even with 10 or 15% of those that are willing to even consider a move in Arizona, Wisconsin, or Michigan, I think it makes Trump's path very, very narrow at that point.
It does. It absolutely does. I think there's a second thing, again, going back to sort of the basics of the election or the plate tectonics, which is that Trump's vote was an older vote.
Absolutely.
65 and plus, that was his demographic. Older and in rural places. So it helped him in the Electoral College because the rural states have more Electoral College votes than they should, according to population. So his Electoral College vote was kind of a fluke because of that. His older base means, just not to be ghoulish about it, not many of them will be around in 2024. Biden's base was very young. And while Biden's young base is mad at him about things like Hamas, et cetera, the fact is, the one thing we know about young voters is that as they get older, they vote more. And they don't tend to disappear from the electorate the way older voters do, i.e. they don't die. And so you've got just those fundamentals. I would guess that there are more Biden voters still around than there are Trump voters.
I will say this. In Florida, I know this, it's my home turf, you can count on a 4% turnover of senior voters every single year. And they're going to turn over. It's not an optional formation. You know, demographics and actuarial tables do what they do.
Right, exactly. And that is not the case for younger voters.
Right. And I think I do think you're right. There is a little restiveness among younger voters with Joe Biden right now. They're a little bit angry. They're a little bit, you know, they're pissed off about Israel and Gaza, Hamas and Palestine, all those questions rolled up. But I mean, I still have a fundamental belief that by the time the election gets closer and younger voters do tend to engage a little later, I still believe that by the time we get there, it's going to be very difficult to find younger voters who are like, well, you know, Donald Trump is a much better option for me as a younger person than Joe Biden. I have so much trouble believing that that's going to be the case.
Yeah. I mean, look, it wasn't the case in two past elections that had Donald Trump in them. In 2016 and 2020, he lost big time among younger voters. So, and the single issue that seems to be driving younger voters into a more skeptical stance about Biden is the war in Israel. And the problem there is what they don't know yet, but I'm assuming the Biden campaign will use some of its $155 million to tell them, is that when it comes to the Middle East, Trump has been much, much more aggressive.
Oh, sure.
Totally behind Netanyahu, mm-hmm. much less sympathetic to the Palestinians. And it's not, if that is your issue and you're putting Biden next to Trump, you're going to end up with Biden because he is calling for a ceasefire. As you know, that the United States abstained in the last United Nations meeting on this. So, and as we know, Biden is really pissed off at Netanyahu for the way he's conducting the war. So if you, and by the way, Trump has been very silent on this.
Isn't that interesting? He's been very, very nervous about saying a word about it.
Right. But I'm sure that there are people in the Biden campaign who are dredging up old TV clips of Donald Trump's comments about Netanyahu, et cetera. And that with some of that money that they've been raising, they'll make sure that young people know what the difference is.
And I do think that's one thing we can't overlook here. There is so much money. There's such a money differential right now in the two campaigns. And I tell people this a lot. Not every money counts in huge ways, not in the way that it might have in 25 years ago, but it still really counts for a lot. And right now, Joe Biden is outgunning Donald Trump on every single financial axis, not just by a little, but by a lot.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And, you know, the money differential isn't going to change the Trump base. After all, everybody knows everything there is to know about Donald Trump. But the money is important for that sliver of the electorate that is yet to make up their minds or is new to the electorate. And that's where the money's going to really matter.
Yeah, I think that's right. Folks coming in. Yeah, and it used to be this sort of luxury in America where we didn't have to worry about politics every day. And people, I think people miss that, but I do believe we're going to end up in a situation where people that are late engagers on this they're going to fall into two categories. They've either deliberately been looking away, which I'm fine with. I get it. I get why one would, or they're going to see this at the moment of decision and say, I can't deal with the chaos. I just can't do it. I can't face the chaos. And I think that's going to be, I think the chaos is something that offsets a lot of Biden's smaller, not insignificant, not inconsequential, but smaller problems. You know, is Biden a little more boring than Trump? Absolutely. I think people might like that in the end. Is his base a little restive? Yeah. Do they want the best to be the enemy of the good? Of course they do. But let me ask you another question. Where do you see the third party shenanigans going on right now? I feel that No Labels is about to basically roll over. They've lost one of their key leaders with the passing of Senator Lieberman, and they can't seem to get a candidate for their ticket. Where do you see RFK and No Labels playing into this election?
I agree with you. I think No Labels is finished. I think no one will run on them. They've only got on a ballot on 19 states. They had previously said they'd be on the ballot in 30 states. Not being on the ballot in all states means you are a spoiler ipso facto. You simply cannot win. And their 19 states don't add up to 270 electoral college votes. So you simply can't win. And I think everybody who's looked at this has said, well, you know, they talked a good game, but you know, the kind of money, you know, when they went out, when they announced months ago, they said they were going to raise $70 million. Well, that sounds like a lot of money to most people. If you study presidential campaigns and presidential nominating campaigns, $70 million is bupkis.
Right.
It's nothing. Okay. Right. It is absolutely nothing.
It's pocket change.
It really, really is nothing. I mean, the two national parties spend vastly more on that just running their nomination process, okay? Just running their primaries and running their convention, et cetera, vastly more than that. So I think that people are looking at this and saying, no, this dog don't hunt. Kennedy's challenge is a little bit more serious. First of all, he's got the name recognition, and he's built on that name recognition. And he's really gets some enough in the polls that he could definitely be a spoiler. He, however, is not on many state ballots, but the two he's on are two of the big ones. It's Arizona and Georgia. He's not on, you know, he's on the Utah state ballot. Well, Utah's not going to go Democratic.
Okay? No, trust me on this one.
Yeah, right. We can bet on that. So what is worrisome about Kennedy is that in a couple of swing states, he could take votes from Biden. That's the assumption. The assumption is he'll take votes from Biden because of his environmental past, because of his name, et cetera. However, there are people who insist that because of his anti-vax positions, which are shared by a lot of conservatives, that he might take votes from Trump too.
I think that's the case. I think that a lot of the crypto stuff, the conspiracy stuff, the anti-vax stuff, that seems to me to be very aligned with a lot of Trump voters.
Right. But, you know, I keep being reminded of a little piece I read about his appearance before the Libertarian Party convention back in California. This was about 2 months ago. And what was fascinating about it is that, you know, getting on the Libertarian line, by the way, would be very helpful because
sure. they're in all 50 states.
They're on all 50 states. So that would have solved his problems right then and there. However, what happened was when he appeared before them and the delegates there started looking at him, they said, wait a minute, this guy's been for big government. This guy started out as an environmentalist. He's been for all sorts of environmental regulation. We don't like him. Okay.
Right.
So he's kind of a weird combination of very conservative stuff, the crypto and the anti-vax, and very liberal stuff, which is his environmental background. So who knows who he'll take from, but he is doing much better than Cornel West or Jill Stein, who are invisible.
Yeah, I think Jill Stein is basically like a spent force. I think the green stuff I think enough progressives after 2016 realized that indulging Jill Stein is why we didn't get Hillary Clinton, especially in Wisconsin and, you know, with her.
And the fact is that under Biden, you have this, the Inflation Reduction Act really should have been called the Climate Change Act. I mean, that was the biggest amount of money and the biggest move towards, you know, funding anti-fossil fuels that we've ever seen. So it's hard to imagine that serious environmentalists would waste their vote on the Green Party.
Yeah, I think we've ended up in the point where the third party numbers that, unless it's an RFK, a third party candidate now, they're going to fall into that 2-3% category tops. They're not going to make a bigger, I think, impact since people are beginning to understand the existential nature of, you know, what it means if you spoil it. And I look, that's why Chris Christie rejected and everybody else has rejected No Labels. They're like, I don't want that to be on my permanent record. I don't want to be the guy who got Donald Trump elected because I went on a third party ballot and peeled enough votes away. But I think you're right. I think Stein and West have basically become invisible. And that I don't think that's a bad thing at this point.
But let me just point out to the audience, Brookings runs we run something called the Presidential Tracker, and we update it every week. And you can go on there and you can see how these five candidates now are doing in terms of media mentions, social media mentions, and money. And it's just interesting to watch them that way.
We'll try to post that on the video feed for this when we wrap this up. But and so where do you see that right now? How are Clinton and Biden stacking up in that? I mean, Donald Trump is like a black hole of media attention, obviously, but not all of it is good media attention, obviously.
That I think may be contributing to the poll numbers. I think people who are not very familiar with politics, they hear about Trump all the time. So when they haven't really paid any attention and then don't really know who's running, but boy, they hear about Trump 10 times a day because they hear good stuff and bad stuff. And they just say Trump because it's the name that they've heard most recently. I think that he sucks all the air out of the room. It's very, very difficult for people to get attention when Donald Trump is on the stage. One thing that people have been saying about Trump, which I totally agree with, his campaign is much more disciplined than his campaign. He, however, is a lot crazier. Whether he's got some dementia happening, et cetera, if you actually listen to him at one of these rallies, it's a stream of consciousness with segues off into outer space that make no sense to about anything. And so it's hard to take him seriously. I think he's worse.
And I know, look, as you pointed out, he brought in Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, two very serious people. They're not jokers like a Brad Parscale or a Corey Lewandowski or a Steve Bannon. They are serious campaign people. They know what they're doing. They're operatives. They're people like us. You know, we get it. But I think that there's a degree to which, you know, no matter how good the management structure is, if the CEO is willing to go out and, you know, take his clothes off and run around the stage, you're not going to be able to run a disciplined campaign at the end of the day. And no, people, I don't want to see that. That's an image. No, I don't want to ever think about that image again.
We don't want to see that. No.
So, Elaine Kmark, thank you so, so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate your time. I look forward to having you back on. Tell folks, first off, where they can find you on social media and the Brookings Election Tracker.
Yes, it's the Brookings Presidential Election Tracker. Watch the race that way.
I love it. Thank you so much, Elaine. So on the enemies list today is a returning favorite. It's Marge, the three-toed, the human sloth, Marjorie Taylor Greene. Now look, folks, I have zero, and I do mean to say zero brief for Mike Johnson. If Mike Johnson were being eaten by wolves, I would throw more barbecue sauce on him. But the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene is now trying to blow up Mike Johnson, and on Friday decided she would make a move on trying to use the rules that were put into place by the now ex-speaker Kevin McCarthy that allowed the MAGA terrorists to blow him up anytime they wanted. The fact that that is her play at a moment where the country is in absolute immediate peril of default and everything else because of shutting the government down with the last few bills in the shutdown package, and because she's doing it based purely on her own amusement and trying to get clicks and to raise money and to go on Fox about it, puts her on this week's enemies list. Thanks again for listening to the enemies list. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.